Richard, Kamala Harris came out here a week or so ago with her economic policy agenda. It included a proposal for price controls. Can you tell us a bit about price controls? What are they? And has anybody ever had any success with them in the past?
It's a great question. So price controls are a retread of the worst parts of socialism. And to my knowledge, no society in human history has ever had success with them. So and here's why, right? The first question you have to ask yourself is, why do we have prices at all? I mean, it would be great if you could just walk into a store, grab whatever you want off the shelf, not have to pay anyone for anything, and walk out right out the door again, right? The reason we have prices is that we are limited in what we can produce. If we could produce an infinite amount of everything you ever wanted, then you know what? There'd be no price. You'd be able to snap your fingers and have whatever product you want materialize in front of you. And maybe in the 35th century, we'll have the technology to do that. But right now, we don't. Prices are there to communicate irreplaceable information about how hard it is to produce something, how much complexity there is in the production chain, all of the things that go into making that product available, and then, of course, what the value is to potential consumers of the product. So price controls destroy that real information. They lower the price that you can sell a product for, meaning that you can't make it profitably. If you think of it that way, the price represents what the seller needs to sell it for to be able to actually make the product available at all. So if you restrict the price, then the sellers can't make the product at all, given all of the real constraints on production, so you get shortages. And so that's really all the price controls do. They're a way for the government to virtual signal that they care about people, but they actually get in the way of solving the real problem.
The end result of that, if you have businesses that are making products here, Richard, and they can't make a profit or even cover their costs, are they going to not stop making the product? Wouldn't that ultimately lead to shortages of whatever prices are being controlled?
Absolutely. And, you know, I'll say this as well. I think a lot of people, of course, focus on how large profits are. And the truth is, and we've all seen this, you know, grocery stores, for example, that Harris has been talking about making the spear tip of her price controls attack, routinely have 1-3% profit margins, which isn't a lot. But there's one other thing I want to bring up about this, which is that, you know, a lot of people say that as if, you know, a 20% profit would be a bad thing. But the truth is, profits end up going to one of two places. Sure, there are CEOs that make a lot of money, but we're talking about a fraction of the profit of the overall company. Profits are either spent to expand operations of that company, which is the prime use of profits, or they're sent back out into the economy to become seed capital for other industries. So if you're talking about products where there's already a shortage, right, which is why prices are going up and it's hard to produce things, what you actually want is a high profit margin for that company, because then they can get the hands on the money they need to invest in expanding their production. So that's exactly right, which is that if you set price controls, you not only make it impossible for businesses to meet their cost of production, so they go out of business entirely, but it also means they can't get their hands on the money they would need to build new factories or whatever they need to make those products available. So really what price controls do at the end of the day is create a death spiral that leads to mass shortages, to lack of investment, to a reduction in the accessibility of precisely the thing that in theory you were trying to make more affordable.
One of the reasons why we've had runaway inflation over the past 4 years here, Richard, and one of the reasons why we've had prices go up is because the inputs, specifically energy and other core costs, have risen as a result of Biden administration policies. So how much of her agenda is aimed at bringing down the causes of inflation as opposed to simply trying to treat the symptoms of it?
What I would say is, tragically, it seems like none of her policy prescriptions are actually attempting to bring down those costs. In fact, they're aimed at making it worse. You brought up energy. That's a great example. To literally do anything requires energy, to deliver your food to a grocery store, to keep the fridges in the grocery store cool. And what is she talking about doing? Restricting mining of coal, restricting extraction of oil, shutting down power plants. California right now has spiking energy costs, has rolling blackouts. Much of Europe is seeing that. And California and Europe are seeing it for the same reason, which is green climate change religious zealots who are destroying the ability of their societies to produce affordable energy in chasing this illusion that somehow it's going to deal with climate change. So that's just one of the many things she's talking about. Doing price controls are another. Printing more money at the Fed, which directly cheapens the value of a dollar, creates more inflation. All of these are things that would actually make the entire situation much, much worse.
One of the proposals she also put forth here, there's already a shortage of affordable housing in the country. Housing costs have risen dramatically. She's proposing to give first-time homebuyers $25,000, not quite sure where the money is going to come from. What impact would flooding the housing market with that type of an incentive have?
Well, it's a great question. And of course, you know, as you were just talking about, the supply is constricted. And so throwing more money into it doesn't build more houses magically, so it creates inflation. But that's just one side of the story. You were also asking, where does the money come from? The Fed. That's the other side of this story, which is the way she would get her hands on that money is by simply printing it. And that's the story of inflation. It's more dollars chasing fewer goods and services. The money isn't a roof over your head. It isn't clothes on your back. It isn't food. I wouldn't try eating cash if you're thinking of doing it. So when the Fed prints more money, it's not printing more stuff. It's not building more houses or making more food. It's simply devaluing each dollar you have and transferring that purchasing power to the people who get the new dollars. If they print $25,000 up at the Fed for each new home buyer, the purchasing power that's being siphoned is coming from everybody else. So everybody else sees higher inflation just so that those handful of people can get a slightly better position trying to buy a home, but oh wait, the prices on homes will be going up because of the new printed money. Again, it's this inflation shortage death spiral that all of her policies point toward.
As a follow-up to that, a few days later, her campaign said that she wants to raise the corporate income tax, the corporate net income tax, from the current 21% to 28%. Would that have also an adverse impact on the economy in terms of what producers might do?
Absolutely. So I think one of the most important things that I always tell people is corporations don't pay that tax. Sure, they file the tax, but they're not the one that feels the burden. In fact, when you point to a corporation, it is literally just a legal vehicle. It's a contract that has a collection of stores and factories and delivery trucks, et cetera, under the corporate shell. The people who feel the burden are everybody else. And specifically, the vast majority of the burden of corporate taxes is felt by the workers of that company, and it's felt by the consumers of its products. And, you know, even then, like I was saying earlier, to the extent that that tax comes out of profits, really what it's doing is either coming out of growth in that company, right? That's money that could have built a new factory that instead goes as tax money to the government, or it's money that would have been returned to the economy and used to invest in another business. So oddly enough, right, raising the corporate tax not only means that you're hiking prices for consumers, you're cutting wages for workers, it also means that that company doesn't build factories or new businesses. But even more interestingly enough, a corporate rate hike means that there's less money that gets to new, small, and startup businesses. So at the end of the day, raising the corporate tax rate is a disaster. And it's not just a disaster for numbers on a page. It is a disaster for workers, for families, and for small and startup businesses.
We have been talking with Richard Stern, who is director of the Grover M. Herman Center for the Federal Budget at the Heritage Foundation, which, of course, is based in Washington, D.C. Richard, tell us just a little bit about Heritage and where can folks find you on the website?
Well, so we are the flagship conservative think tank. We've been around for 50 years now. We're the largest conservative think tank in the country. We talk about public policy, help craft legislation. You can find us, of course, at heritage.org. You can find my bio page there and everything I write and that of my colleagues as well.
Richard Stern of the Heritage Foundation. Richard, thank you for being with us.
It's been a pleasure, and thank you for having me on.